The following is a podcast of Periodically Speaking, recorded live at the New York Public Library on June 10th, 2008.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Karen Ciccone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals and Journals. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here tonight. On behalf of the New York Public Library. We love hosting this event. We love collaborating with CLMP. It gives us an opportunity to provide a venue for writers to read their new work, also to hear editors talk about their magazine, and lastly, and majorly in some way, to highlight the literary magazine collection here at the library and literary magazines in general. So it's really great to see you all. I want to encourage you to come back and check out the library and check out the wonderful collections that we have here, either in person or on the internet. Also, you can find our podcasts. We've got three that were posted recently of our programs this spring. And so I encourage you to check that out at nypl.org. It's also available on iTunes. You're invited to stay around after the reading for a reception, which is going to be right outside, and also to look out this Saturday for the Magathon, which is going to be held here in this room at 4 o'clock. So hopefully we'll see some of you there then. Many thanks to CLMP, Tasha, and Jeffrey particularly for being so great. We love where the library has found some really great partners in CLMP. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Jeffrey Leckendorf, who's the Executive Director of CLMP, and he will introduce tonight's program. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen, and thanks to all of you for coming. Those listening on iTunes, by the way, we're now on iTunes. Type in Periodically Speaking, and you can relive every precious moment you're enjoying right now, again, on your iPod. For those of you who are listening online, it's 1,000 degrees outside today, but it's nice and cool in here, and I'm happy you all showed up. A brief word about CLMP, the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses. There's a little cheat sheet in front of you with some quick answers to commonly asked questions about what we are, but I'll say briefly that the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, CLMP, we are now celebrating our 40th anniversary. We were founded 40 years ago by Russell Banks, George Plimpton, and other literati who understood the importance of independent literary publishing to us having a vital and vibrant literary landscape in America. This series allows us to celebrate some of our favorite literary magazines of the some thousand that are actively publishing across the United States. You can come here to the library and check them out at any time. And I do hope you'll join us, those of you here today, this Saturday and Sunday. This is, in fact, coming up, the Lit Mag Marathon Weekend. Yay! The Lit Mag Marathon Weekend, where we have the Magathon here at the New York Public Library at 4, where you will be able to see and hear some two dozen, I forget how many, a whole bunch, of literary magazine editors reading works themselves that they have recently published. And on Sunday at Housing Works Used Book Cafe down in Soho, an opportunity to purchase for only $2 a copy, literally less than it costs to print many of them, armfuls of literary magazines. We have over 100 different magazines there, many with their editors present. So it's a good chance to also meet the secret gatekeepers behind America's emerging voices. We have three great magazines today. The first is from the city of Cincinnati, the city that Paul Auster claimed has no sin in it. So maybe we'll have that confirmed or denied in just a moment by its editor, Brock Clark.
According to everyone who I've spoken to tonight, apparently the sin is me wearing this jacket. Just gotten me a raftload of shit since I entered this building. So it's my pleasure to be here, really is, even though I've gotten all that grief about my jacket. In fact, I just talked to someone who said that I signed a book to him praising his plaid jacket and him taking credit for the one I'm wearing. Anyways, I'm not here to talk about my jacket. I'm here to talk about the magazine. And then Kevin Wilson. I'm the fiction editor of Cincinnati Review, and I also teach in and direct the University of Cincinnati's Creative Writing Program, which houses and publishes the magazine. We publish 2 issues a year, winter and summer, and in each issue we feature fiction, poetry, nonfiction, reviews, in addition to an 8-page color spread of artwork. We're just starting our 5th year. Our summer 2008 issue is now in the shelves. Is this too loud? Okay. Loud enough. But in that short time, stories, poems, and essays first appearing in our magazine have been anthologized in Best American Short Stories, Best American Poetry, Best American Essays, Best American Mystery Stories, Best American Fantasy, the Pushcart Prize Anthology, and Best Of, New Stories from the South. We've published Pulitzer Prize winners, we've published first-time authors, and I'm happy to say we've also published Kevin Wilson. Kevin's story, Grandstandin', appeared in our winter 2005 issue. I don't want to ruin the story for you by saying too much about it, except to say that it's the lead story in his brilliant debut collection, Tunneling to the Center of the Earth, which we published by Echo HarperCollins in spring 2009. The collection is full of characters you won't be able to forget and wouldn't want to even if you could. A baby born with a full set of teeth, a lonely docent in the Museum of Whatnot, an adrift college grad who decides to give himself a sense of purpose by tunneling to the center of the earth, and, sorry, a circus act who gets shot in the face night after night after night, and in the case of the story the Cincinnati Review published, a grandmother for hire. Kevin has a healthy appreciation for the bizarre, obviously, but more than that, his freaks are so lovingly and beautifully rendered that you begin to envy them. After first reading Grandstandin', I was jealous of the mercenary fake grandmother. Lucky her, I thought, for being a character in such a tender, one-of-a-kind short story. But then again, lucky for me for having the chance to read and publish it, and lucky for us for having the chance to hear Kevin read from his work tonight. Please welcome Kevin Wilson.
This is an irritating question, but can everyone hear me okay? Is this all right? Okay, a little louder? A little louder, okay. I want to thank CLMP and the library for putting this on. It's very wonderful, and I especially want to thank Brock and the Cincinnati Review for inviting me to come read. It's a real honor, and this is only my second time ever being in New York, And I decided before I got here that I would eat nothing but hamburgers. I would go to all the best hamburger places in New York. And what I have realized after 3 days and 12 hamburgers is that it wasn't a great idea. And the reason I'm telling you this is that if I temporarily go blind or I pass out, you will know what to tell the paramedics when they get here, because I can't feel my feet. Anyways, and so I'm going to read this. This is a story that's not Grandstandin'. It's a new story, and it doesn't have obscenities, but it has a little sex in it, just to tell you. It's called You Amaze Me, You Do. My wife was making potato salad, and she sent me off to get a special kind of mayonnaise, a southern brand that was found only in gas stations and old grocery stores about to go out of business. I drove to the general store in the town square, singing a little song to myself that I'd made up on the spot that began, "Mayonnaise, you amaze me, you do." I make up a lot of songs in the course of the day, and most of them involve beating the hell out of someone or describing strange sex acts the narrator is about to perform. But with this song, I felt like I could sing it in public and people would join in, following me through the aisles of the store. Singing and smiling, I pulled into a parking space, and it seemed to me that I was spectacularly drunk, though I wasn't, and I figured this was the kind of happiness that regular people might experience on a particularly good day. Before I entered the store, there was a girl standing by the bins of clothes on clearance that were out on the sidewalk. She had a tiny skirt that just barely covered the things that a skirt should cover, and she'd cut her t-shirt in the front so that you could see more of her, though there wasn't much there. Her chest hard and flat and dotted with freckles. She looked like she was 17, but she had so much makeup on, it seemed like she could be in her 30s as well. She was, I understood on instinct, a prostitute, which was surprising because even though nearly every shop in the town square had gone out of business, I had not thought it had gotten this bad. She smiled as I walked by, and I smiled, trying to be civil, and she touched my arm and said, "Baby, you want to buy me a candy bar?" I was too scared to answer, and I entered the store, and she said, as the door closed behind me, "Something sweet." I found the mayonnaise stacked up by a table of men's work pants, and at the cash register, I looked at the small selection of candy. My mom, before she died, told me that when she was a child and very poor, she had prayed to God that she'd be rich enough to have a Hershey's chocolate bar with almonds every single night. She'd been crazy on morphine at the end, and I remember she held my hand, and I kissed her, and she said, "Hershey bars with almonds were Yoko Ono's favorite candy bar." Those weren't her last words, thank God. She lived a few more days before she finally died. As I paid for the mayonnaise, I threw a Hershey bar with almonds on the counter, and the lady at the register smiled at me, and I wondered if she knew whom it was for. Outside, I gave the girl the candy bar. She ate half of it in front of me and smiled. "I like it sweet," she said, and I knew I was blushing. I wished I'd bought a candy bar for myself so I could look casual out here on the sidewalk with her. "Are you looking for a date?" she said, and I instantly got hard and said, "Yes, yeah, I think so." Even as I was saying it, I was thinking about how stupid this was, how, if I was smart, life would be more like a commercial for something I already owned and approved of greatly. Once we got situated in the car, she got less flirtatious and turned serious. "Take a left here," she kept saying, going around in circles, it seemed. I already wanted to get out of this situation, but I wasn't sure how to do it. This seemed to happen often, me doing something stupid that I had, before it occurred, correctly determined was stupid. I'd never in my life been surprised by the awful turns my life had taken, and I wondered if it was like that for most people. I thought of my wife, waiting for the mayonnaise, wondering if the brand had been discontinued, and hoping I hadn't messed things up. I'd been with a prostitute only once before, when I was a freshman in college in Nashville. I'd gone with a guy that I had only met a few days previous to a burger joint that was in a bad part of town. We stood in a pretty long line, and this woman, ripped up skirt and cowboy boots, cut in line in front of us and said, "Would you boys like some company for dinner?" We were too scared to say no. We bought her a bacon cheeseburger and some fries, and halfway into the meal, she pointed to me and she said, "Do you got a car?" I pointed to my friend and I said, it's his car." She looked at my friend and said, and then pointed at me and said, give him the keys." She wiped her mouth with a napkin and pushed me out of the booth, and we got in the car, and I turned on the radio, but she turned it off. $20 for my hand and $30 for my mouth," she said, and I wondered if there was something for $5 that only involved holding hands, but I gave her $20, and she jerked me off as people walked past the car, which made it hard to concentrate. Nothing was really working, it was taking too long, and she finally said, without looking up at me, "You don't finish soon, it's gonna be $10 more. I came almost instantly, surprising myself, and we went back inside, and she finished her meal and then pointed to my friend, and they went to the car while I sat there and stared at the rest of my meal, afraid to eat anything. Afterwards, my friend dropped me off at my dorm, and we didn't speak to each other for the next 4 years. Back in the car, still making turns, I started to sing the mayonnaise song again, and she looked at me and said, "Oh, don't sing a song I've never heard before. I do not like that." I told her it was a song that I just recently made up, but she didn't say anything. And finally, she told me to pull into a parking lot for a motel. "Oh, I thought this place had burned down," I said, and she looked at me like I was retarded. "It didn't burn down," she said, rolling her eyes, "obviously." We got out, and I asked if I needed to pay for a room or if we could maybe split the cost between us, and she said, "Nobody stays here anymore. It's gone out of business." I started to wonder why we hadn't discussed the terms of the situation, money, and how much of it, but I was afraid of pissing her off any further. She walked up to a door, knocked 3 times, then 2 times, then 1 time. And when no one responded, she opened the door and motioned for me to go inside. I started towards the room and then remembered the mayonnaise, which I did not want to spoil in the hot sun, and so I went and got the paper bag. Can I bring this with me?" I asked, and she hissed, "Sweetie, I don't give a shit what you do. Just get inside before someone comes by and we both get in trouble." For the first time since I'd met her, I remembered that what was about to happen was illegal, that I could go to jail, my name in the police blotter, my wife screaming at me while I ate potato salad that wasn't nearly as good as it usually was. I stepped inside the room, the bed stripped of any sheets, and I felt something hit me solid across the back of my head, a huge cracking sound like a tree had snapped in half. And I stumbled across the room, lost my grip on the paper bag, and crashed into a nightstand. After a few seconds, I looked over my shoulder and the girl was standing there with a splintered 2x4. She looked shocked that I wasn't dead. I was still very much awake. I'd lost every fight I'd ever been in, but I'd never been knocked out, was always aware of just how bad things were going. "Jesus," I said, feeling the huge knot already forming on my head, my hand cut open from smashing into a lamp. I'm gonna pay you." She threw the piece of wood on the floor and held out her open hand. "Give me the money," she said, angry as hell. Yeah, but how much?" I asked. "All of it," she said, now looking out the door, getting jumpy. "For crying out loud, give me all your money. I'm robbing you. Give me all your money." I reached for my wallet and counted out the bills, $73, and she took it, shoved it in her shoe and ran off, leaving me in the room by myself. The mayonnaise had fallen out of the bag and rolled under the bed. My dad had slept with a cleaning woman at the factory where he worked, and when she got pregnant, he told my mom about it and offered to move out of the house. My mom didn't want him to go anywhere. "Well, I don't want you to leave," she said. And he said, "Well, I don't want to leave either." And they paid the cleaning woman $2,000, and they never saw her again, and it seemed like they were more in love after that than they'd ever been before. I put the mayonnaise back in the bag and got in my car, my hand not bleeding as bad as it had seemed. I wondered what I had to be ashamed of. It felt like a lot and very little at the same time. I had the mayonnaise. It just happened to cost $73 more than it should have. I had no idea how to explain the knot on my head, my cut hand, and I didn't even try to think of an excuse. I'd take it as it came. Driving home, I saw the half-eaten chocolate bar on the floorboard and I retrieved it. It was slightly melted, but it tasted so sweet that I felt like I finally understood what my mom had wanted as a child, a treat that never got old, the knowledge that at least one thing in your life would not be terrible. I sang my little song, "Mayonnaise, you amaze me, you do," and I felt happy to know that my life would keep going, that being alive, though I had tried so hard to convince myself otherwise, was so much better than being dead. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. It probably won't be an enticement to you to know that upon a third visit to New York, you are offered a coupon for a free burger, but I do hope you'll come back. A couple of quick thank yous. We're able to be in this magnificent space and offer free programs through the generosity of a few enlightened funders, which include the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, as well as Friends of CLMP, enlightened individuals who help support us. What the funders get back from this event are the survey forms that are in front of you, and please do take just a moment with the tiny pencils you see before you to fill them out before you go. The feedback is really what they get out of it, aside from the joy of writing checks to us. And it's also your opportunity to give us your email address if you like to find out about other free events that we put on, like the Magathon this weekend and when Periodically Speaking begins again in the fall. So don't miss out. One of the particularly important functions of literary magazines is representing often entire communities that are largely overlooked by mainstream publishing. And the next magazine is a model example of that. And so I now call up to the podium Ron Cavanaugh, editor of Mosaic Magazine.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. I'm always, always honored and pleased to do any reading, participate in any way with a CLMP event. They're a really great organization. If there are any magazines or editors here who are not part of CLMP, please join before you leave. Thank you so much. I just want to read a brief statement about my wonderful magazine. That's my opinion. I didn't ask anyone else. Launched in the bio you have on the orange sheet says 1988, but actually it's 1998. I am not that old. Launched in 1998, Mosaic Literary Magazine is a quarterly publication exploring the literary art created by writers of African descent. Through articles, essays, book reviews, and interviews, Mosaic has increased the literary reach of some of the most important voices affecting change on many artistic fronts. In our short history, which is now 10 years, we have interviewed such artists as Nikki Finney, Lucille Clifton, Bernice McFadden, Colson Whitehead, Walter Mosley, Stacey Ann Chin, Major Jackson, Elin Harris, Chimamanda Adichie, and Sonia Sanchez, among others. Mosaic is considered, again, this is my opinion, Mosaic is considered one of the most relevant publications for independent readers who desire exceptional writing, essays, and book reviews. One of the people who have done a lot of writing, essays, and book reviews for us is Tara Betts. Tara Betts teaches creative writing at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and with Dream Yard in the Bronx, New York. By the way, I am a lifelong resident of the Bronx, born and raised. If anybody's in the Bronx, please stop by, say hello. In addition to Mosaic, her work has appeared in numerous anthologies and journals, including Essence Magazine, Kalalu, PMS, Poem Memoir Story, that's all one word, Ocho, and Gathering Ground. She is a Cave Canem Fellow and will be a writer in residence at Soul Mountain this summer. Without further ado, she was stuck in the Lincoln Tunnel just like 10 minutes ago. So here is Tara Betts.
Good evening, everybody. I was a little bit nervous about being late, but I'm glad the tunnel did not keep me at bay. I'll start with some new poems, like new poems, at least for me. The first one was inspired in part by watching the Sean Bell protests that were taking place throughout the city. And for some reason, my volume was down on my television. All I kept hearing in my head was part of John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. So it came out of that, which the part I was thinking of was called Resolution. No Rush Hour Resolution for Nicole Bell. Quiet noticing bubbles through blacktop as handfuls of people form statues on the street. The blare of silent prayers serve as glaring horns behind their eyes. Each bleat screaming, no, not anymore, not now, as if the holler split from Coltrane's reed and breath. The wind getting insistent in each note, don't let it happen no more. Nicole knows the play, its predictable score, teased from 51 leaks, priming her as sorrow sculpture. Single mother of two daughters, widow who says they have a father. In the rush, piano keys rise, kicking soundtrack through fury. Police smell love and principle in thick defiance spread over crosswalks. They grab one reverend who holds hands willing for cuffs, then push his head like a puny bullied child. The crowd flutters and floods the officers' ears. Horns protest in open mouths, mimicking bells silenced everywhere, clabbers stilled or snatched beyond teeth. When the plastic handcuffs imitate some stiff symbol of lopsided infinity tightening around wrists, hushed prayers are shoved from clogged, corrupt arteries flowing with green blood and oiling the wheels of paddy wagon doors. The song has not ended. The drums roll lightning's lover across the sky. The warning rings clear as McCoy Tyner gnashing each delicate key, a bite into meat. The song pounds inside heads. Every oppression don't last always. Even as newscasters announce crowds dispersing, silent prayers drift like dandelion seeds, difficult to unroot, while Coltrane keeps playing an unresolved version of A Love Supreme's Part 2. My second poem, I try to keep it a little bit light, have some balance. I've been imagining figures that from popular culture thinking about different things we don't normally see them doing. So hence math according to James Brown. Use what you got equals get what you want. A man's world minus a woman or a girl equals zero. Say it loud is parallel to I'm black and I'm proud. Fever plus cold sweat plus get it up plus stay on the scene plus take it to the bridge equals sex machine. Talk aloud equals saying nothing. Zero times the sum of yelling plus fuss plus heart equals Papa don't take no mess. Holler plus cuss plus wanna fight divided by the sum of getting down plus my girlfriend plus sold me out times backstabbing equals big payback. A typical JB sequence. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, hot pants. Royalties minus taxes plus 3,000 documented samples equals estate. Add the sum of these equations to variables bred in Augusta soil to make it funky while living in America. So, short poem. I often find myself thinking of historical events, and I think one of the first things that I experienced being in New York was watching the Hurricane Katrina footage. And the thing that really shook me was some of the things that the newscasters chose to say. You know, we all have different ways we interpret the news, especially in this day and age. And one of the journalists had said something in the poem that I'll tell you when you get there. And Hurricane Kwame offers his 2 cents. My sister Katrina just twist whipped the Big Easy. She wanted to see how stone cold she could be. You know, us hurricanes don't start off as giant funnel cakes, rolling houses and trees into sweet death. We're usually just some restless stirrings, rustling waves like fluffy baby locks blowing across the Atlantic's head. You could say our rotating relatives were Africans born on the continental coast. Of course, our cousins from the Pacific come mostly from South America and Mexico, but those Olmec heads look a lot like faces back home. She can't front and say they were making too much Zydeco jazz rumbling saturated with gin and hoodoo. I mean, even God understands a party every now and then, and all them Loas look just like Jesus. These reverends preaching cleansing have no idea how close hurricanes curl toward the ears of God. In fact, my girl Rita decided to visit Texas just to rattle the faith of that president boy's skull, that brain clattering around in his head like a mess of dried beans. These journalists lack just as much sense talking about people looting. Well, hell, I must be one of nature's looters, snatching from whatever these newspapers call civilization. Ain't it human nature to eat, drink water, diaper a baby? At least one journalist got it right, though. Spelled my name correct and everything. He said this hurricane should have been called Kwame or Keisha. But still, I'm not so sure that was a compliment, since some hold African names they don't like so tight in their jaw, you'd think someone still made up names for chattel, like unmarked graves, wishing that the family Bible remembered them. I feel like I've been privileged to be a part of a lot of poetry readings in different communities, and one of the things that I think is beautiful about every poetic tradition is we find time not only to remember the really tragic things, but also to look at things that we can celebrate and the things that are beautiful about where we come from. And I got really frustrated at one point with hearing some of the things people say and continually harping about what happens. And I thought of this story that somebody told me, and this is a retelling of it. For those who need a true story, the landlord told Raymond's mother that $12 would be deducted from their rent for every rat killed. She sends her son to the store for a loaf of Wonder Bread and 5 pounds of ground beef. Young Raymond returns with bread and meat that she tears and mixes inside a metal bowl. Mama seasons this meatloaf with rat poison pulled from the cabinet beneath the sink. Well done. Meat sits steaming in the middle of the kitchen floor. Then the scratching scurries. The squeaking begins and screeches its way toward the bowl. Raymond describes the wave of rats like a tidal crash, covering the bowl, leaping over each other's bodies, then the dropping, the stutter kicks. A chorus of rat screams ramble through Raymond's ears, keening furry bodies, tense paws against churning guts as they hit cracked linoleum and out until an hour passes. Silence swept away the din and death's footsteps. The mother's voice quivers in her next request. Raymond, help me count them. They waded through these small deaths with rubber gloves, listened to the thump of each dead rat as it rustled against the slackness of plastic bags. Raymond wanted to stop counting, but Mama needed us to save $12 wherever she could if they wanted to finally leave the rats behind. After the last rat was counted, Raymond handed the bag to the landlord as proof. Here, enough rats to skip the rent for 3 months. Enough rats to avoid the fear of sweet sleeping breath leading to bitten lips. Healthy children, wrapped in designer dictates, cannot describe Raymond's fear of rabies, the smell of poison rotting from the inside out, the scratching inside the walls at night. Those children should find soft lives that drop pendulums in their dreams and never tell another story about the ghetto till they've had to count rats with their hands. Like I said, trying to balance it, some lighter matter. I know since it's summertime, this is probably the best time for me to read this poem, because we all wish we had something cool to drink, and it's a sort of a love poem, Making Kool-Aid. Faucet sprays into the pitcher. Gray powder dissipates into red, dissolving white granules, shrinking into sticky, invisible presence. 2 cups of sugar disappearing underwater. Inside the pitcher, water splatters. Big metal spoon with rust spot in the middle thuds against beige plastic. Final short slurp to test sweetness comes too slowly. My father's bellow rises insistent, there better be enough sugar. I look toward the light above the sink, bleeding the same shade of porcelain, this sink where my brothers and I became dish rack neighbors during infant baths. The light could never wash out our color or make us any darker. The light, the flat shade of skim milk. Carefully rinsing red beads off the pitcher, I find myself wanting to do it right. Stir it quickly, get at least 1 glass. Hope time between pitchers stretches. Do it right so you can see the smile spread across his face before diabetes, before divorce, before daddy's girl became daughter distant, as I cling to moments steeped in sugar, sugar, sugar. I feel like I meet so many young people and they have so many stories to tell. But I want to read one of their poems. But I'll read this one. This is a poem that's loosely based on a form, a nonce form from Lucille Clifton called Move. It's in her book, The Book of Light. Totally different subject matter though. Switch. Starts with a quote from a popular MC by the name of Nasir Jones from New York City. Typical day that a black girl sees, coming home wanting more than a college degree. Nas, black girl lost. Crushed zirconium gloss and glory glides across her lips. She looks in the mirror, puckers, pops her gum, knows what would happen if mama saw her switch, girl. Bounce, bounce song scripts pinned into rivets of denim, pressed into thighs, rocking two pocket shorts, cause she can switch, girl. Purveyors of pulp nonfiction sit on regals with chrome rims, mocking constellations, and damn her pelvic metronome. Switch, girl. A poet sketches what he imagines as her fantasies. Behind his microphone, he paces her into fables of sexual favors for handbags, haphazardly stitches her walk into crack alleys, half tapes her barely breathing body with bruises. Switch, girl. Women sit facing the microphone. The girl is each one of them when she tacks up the periodic table of elements next to cutouts from Right On. She just wanted to be a nurse or just get an A in chemistry quietly while looking like doing something she ain't. Girl, switch. So I'm gonna close with one short poem from my manuscript. And just this whole notion of the dark astronomy lesson. The language of stars rings ancient sprays of laughter into plots beyond axis. Light smashes into arcs, yet distance lies about how close it comes to our eyes. The largest sack of torn marbles scattered with deliberate astronomy offering the oldest calendars. The plans of every moment mapped and looking down at our small dust lives, the tangos between birth and death. This skin blanketing days and glistens, and we have been taught to fear it.
Thank you, Tara. Writers know that literary magazines provide a very necessary and wonderful home for them. And readers discover when they find a magazine that speaks to them that, or hopefully they discover that not only are they reading wonderful literature, but they're also joining a community of readers who share their sensibility, which is a very, very special thing. And what makes a periodical particularly wonderful is that it is periodical. It will keep coming out, and you can keep reading other work that you know you're going to enjoy because it does match that sensibility. The way that you as readers can help ensure that these literary magazines keep publishing is by subscribing to them. So if you find a magazine that speaks to you, please subscribe to it. So a little pitch on behalf of everyone here. Finally, our third selection. I can say this of only so many people. I'm going to introduce a gentleman who was both a good guy and I hope you won't mind me saying a genuine eminence crusade. Bob Fogarty, Robert Fogarty of the Great Antioch Review.
Thank you very much. It's always a wonderful pleasure to come to this library in particular. Paul Auster would be surprised by this evening's presentations because the center of literary culture has shifted from Brooklyn to the Bronx and Ohio. And that's where the real action is, not in that fetid place that I grew up in, two blocks literally from where Mr. Auster now lives. I also went to school in the Bronx, and one of the things that I did, which was a great pleasure, was that I came to the room 315 upstairs, which was the American History Room at that time, and did all the research for my my undergraduate work, and that when that room was renovated, a filing cabinet was given to us. So we have in Yellow Springs, Ohio, a filing cabinet from the New York Public Library, which reminds me, A, of my roots, and B, of the fact that card catalog systems, which we now have a modern one, remained important and still remain important. I should say that the Antioch Review, which has been associated with Antioch College for a long time, will continue to publish despite the unfortunate fact that the college has been suspended and will close as of the end of June. But the Antioch Review will continue, and I hope will thrive. We have several forthcoming issues. We have an all-fiction issue coming out this summer with a lead story by Gordon Lish, and a whole series of other 15 other writers, actually. And in the winter, we have an all-poetry issue, which we do about every 3 years. We're a magazine, as some of you may know, that regularly publishes fiction, essays, and poetry. And we continue to read, although it's quite difficult to read the slush. We read it, we pay attention to it. Let me make a few other remarks before getting to Maureen. Independent and alternative magazines have basically a non-commercial aesthetic. Basically, the decisions are made not on the basis of commerce, but they're made on the basis of the merits of a story or a poem or an essay or a review. That's different in the commercial world, and one of the functions of literary magazines is to preserve that aesthetic in the face of difficulties, as you all know. It's very hard for such magazines to avoid commercial labels and tactics, so that, as you all well know, emerging writers is really, in some ways, a marketing scheme. It's a way of identifying an audience for another audience. And I think that that's an important function of a magazine, but we have to be careful with regard to simply labeling emerging, meaning young. Writers emerge at all ages, from all places, and produce all kinds of quite different work, and therefore, what it means to emerge. I've asked Maureen McCoy, who is a published novelist, as you can see from your cheat sheet, and has been teaching at Cornell University for some time in the creative writing program. She is, however, an emerging memoirist, and I have published two memoir pieces of hers, which I think are wonderful, and there will be more. And I'd just like to read something I wrote for the introduction to this issue of the Antioch Review, which contained the story that she has heroically cut from 20 pages to reading it in 15 minutes. It'll be remarkable if she's able to do it. Let me just say a word about Maureen McCoy. Maureen McCoy opens this volume with a memoir about her father, who returned from the last good war a changed man. A man she did not know or understand till after his death. Her essay is an exercise in deliverance and exorcism as she tells a painful tale about her father that emerged in small ways in condolence notes, conversations with her mother, and documents taken from his wallet. Her father broke the rules of familialism and reveals a larger man than she had ever imagined. This is a memoir at its best and more than creative nonfiction, since it deals with essential truths rather than a constructed narrative. And I think that the power of a constructed narrative is one thing, but telling a true story with all that means is even more powerful. Maureen McCoy.
Oh, thank you all for being here. And now, can you hear me okay? Okay, great. Oh, well, first of all, I want to thank Bob Fogarty, who it really is a fluke that I've had these memoir pieces published. I'm dedicating this reading to my colleague, Ken McLean, who is really one of the great essayists around, somebody who teaches at Cornell, who in passing in the hall saw me very agitated, and I said, oh, I don't know, I'm writing something very weird and different for me. And he said, well, you know, there's the Antioch Review, and I don't know, there's a special issue coming up, but it's probably too late. But somehow I got in gear and sent an essay, and shockingly, Bob Fogarty published it, and then the second one too. So yes, this is the diet version of an essay that was published. It may not be dietetic enough, but you know, I guess an essay can never be too thin, and maybe the next version will be even thinner. It's called Vicky's Poorhouse, P-O-U-R, A Soldier's Peace. The envelope addressed to Mrs. Johnny McCoy tips me off that the writer was an old bar friend of my father. I have discovered the cache of sympathy cards 30 years after my father's death in my mother's bottom dresser drawer. Clearing the house is an ongoing process still, 2 years since my mother died, sorting, remembering, and making new connections from doing both. I have discovered a pin that belonged to her father, who raised his family on the Minnesota Iron Range, Catholic forester. Did such people sing out Hail Mary as they whacked trails, hauled logs, and baited bears in the Superior National Forest? The saying goes, give time time. And sure enough, the sympathy cards for my father that waited in a little white cardboard box buried by cheerful workday scarves required loads of time to pass, and sadly, my mother's life too, before they could play their part in letting new light shine in my brain and shape a fuller picture of my father. Like the cards, much of my father's life had lain out of reach in an unexamined silence. He had engaged in a secret life, a necessary life of companionable and destructive drinking, too generative of pain for us to acknowledge ever or ask about in a place or places left unnamed. A bigamist could not have separated his worlds more concisely. That other shadow world in downtown Des Moines, the one we shunned and denied, lies vividly before me now in this letter to Mrs. Johnny McCoy. Dear Mrs. Johnny McCoy, it seems odd that we've known Johnny so long and yet never met you. At least I don't think we ever met. My John and your Johnny and me go back at least 24 years. That's our next wedding anniversary. Our men were always shooting pool in those days. And in those days, wherever John went, I went too. I know how much you and the children meant to him. I don't know how many times he told me that he didn't deserve you, and how many times he said later that if he could just hold out until the kids were through school. I don't know how either of you found the strength and the courage for these past years. That's why I felt I should write this note to you, just to tell you how much John and I have admired you and what you did for Johnny, and to tell you that we were very fond of Johnny and shall miss him too. We are proud to have called Johnny friend. Sincerely, Mary Hippen. Then I come across cards that indicate flowers and condolences were sent from Vicky's Poorhouse, the Uptown Tap, and Joe's Place. I relive fleeting waves of shame and the smidgen of defensive pride that rattled me as we toured the effulgent bouquets at the funeral home. My mother, who considered funereal flowers to be nonsense, glanced at the cards, made no comment, and moved on. But who knows what mix of emotion played out for her, and again, when tucking those cards away in the dresser. She had met my father at Drake University, which he attended on the GI Bill, courtesy of the World War II jungle warfare years he would never shake. The downtown corner bars, such as Vicky's Poorhouse, were places that literally poured away my father's paychecks. Vicky's Poor, P-O-O-R house, indeed. Vicky's and the others were joints my mother sometimes called on the nights my father got paid and was obviously not coming straight home. Is John McCoy there? I have to speak with John McCoy. But he had either just left or had not been seen. Because his drinking at the bars caused grief at home, we would not have understood that it also nourished him. His drinking cowled secrecy and silence over us, which forbade our asking or even thinking too much about that world or the comrades therein. Let all that remain a dark, isolated void. Otherwise, we would have to consider why he would spend evenings with nameless people, not us. What was so great about them? In these 12-step days, people may disbelieve or mistrust that my mother managed a shattered war veteran husband with no outside help, nor did she ever disparage our father to us or shrivel into a dry leaf of victimhood. She did not give it all over to religious fate either. Unlike Adam, she did not feature naming all things in this world. She emphasized the positive in life. As for the negative, that which hurt us seemed to have no name or was just too much to explain. My mother took care of the family and fed her inner life with reading and craft projects. For my sister and me, she ran up fabulous clothes on the Singer featherweight, often without bothering to use a pattern, designer clothes, indeed. Upholstering furniture, caning chairs, nothing was beyond her craft eye and hand and enthusiasm to imagine or fix, except, of course, her father. Perhaps her artistic gifts flourished all the more set against that knowledge. I sit for a while with the cards from Vicky's Poorhouse, the Uptown Tap, and Joe's Place. We all miss our friend Johnny very much. Sympathy to you and family. I am touched to think that from each of the taverns, someone emerged into the light of day and went to the florist on behalf of my father. Someone picked out flowers and requested or sought out a card large enough to contain a long list of names, Bud and Bee and Earl, Archie, Don, Ginger, and many more. This designated person had probably collected money at the bar, possibly taken time out of work, perhaps entered a flower shop as if it were a place as fantastical as the moon, and penned in all the names from the list at hand. These people and places sheltered my father and saw him through the years and years of illness and the changes it caused, shingles for a while, and sometimes thin Johnny McCoy would blimp out due to new medication. After his absences, time in the VA hospital, they welcomed him back to the fold. Here, I think now, lay sincere friendship, however blurred or exalted by the drink. At last, in his death, the friends came forward to name themselves. Returning from the South Pacific, a month-long journey by ship, my father saw in a heightened, compressed way the raving, lunatic results of the war. Men gone mad and howling, scalded bodies, physically twisted bodies, and men whose missing parts rendered them as grasping caricatures. He saw torment that would not subside. Both my parents referred to the experience rarely, hurriedly, and never in the company of the other, as wielding enormous impact. The unrelenting ravings and woes displaced from the jungles and packed into unavoidable close quarters were enough to tip toward the deep end a fragile soul journeying home. All that time heading toward the U.S., my father had to think, this is who we are now. He had nothing to do weeks aboard ship but smell, hear, and see human wreckage without escape, tell himself he was lucky, and carry it all in his head as he looked out on an indifferent sea. And what did his small-town, genteel family imagine and want for him on VJ Day but to meet at Yonkers Tea Room for a celebratory outing? His mother would have worn a little hat with the veil crimped high, good jewelry, the works, the costume of the respectable lady lunching at one of the downtown's major tea rooms. His father would have arrived in suit and tie. His sister was always seasonably dressed in fabulous outfits. All would be bursting with love and utter incomprehension. The nightmare was over. Now please resume life. My grandparents had not known for 44 months the location of their son, except in the vaguest terms, somewhere in New Guinea. The odd respite in Australia, every day praying that he still walk the earth. And from that paralysis of dark time, they would forever peer at him, their shaken boy, and ache with love made cautious. The toll of waiting, the miracle of his survival, and the slow dawning of his alteration would gently rock them back and back into memory to the sweet hopes of before. On that day, though, I picture his family clinking teacups, shifting a bit in their seats, finally ordering club sandwiches. Meanwhile, my father had joined the packs of soldiers who roamed the downtown streets, drunk as skunks and demented by freedom. Therein lay the balm that my father would always need. Bars, not the golf course, where he had excelled before the war, would supply it. He could have gone pro, became the wistful family refrain. The unspoken follow was not for the war. I imagine that my father's bar friends were especially needed. After he had been diagnosed with the fatal blood disease, the doctors acknowledged had resulted from his enduring malaria 13 times in New Guinea. He sought relief, hardly an ambition to fault. He found companions, gentle or roaring souls, or gentle turned roaring, perhaps, as the drinking nights wore on. In Vicky's Poorhouse, the Uptown Tap, Joe's Place, and maybe other beer joints, he found acceptance of himself for exactly who he helplessly revealed himself to be, a broken man, scared, funny, compassionate, interested, and likable, a GI vet who could not fathom his family. I come back to Mary Hippen's letter. She suggests that my father was in love with my mother until the end, and he told his world. He loved, damn it. So what if he could not capably act on it? Love is first and always a yearning, the shock felt within that affects body and soul forever. Even the most wretched or blameworthy poor sap might rightly insist, I love. Of course we knew this in our hearts, and in truth, helplessness ran both ways. We could not help my father out of his fix. Along with the sympathy letters and flower cards, I find my father's wallet. I cry when I see that forever he carried small photos of my mother, young and lovely, from their Drake University courting days. I wonder if my mother knew he carried these photos. Grasping at his wallet, mad to find money, did she ever notice? The wallet is crusted and curled over on itself. It is slim, as if money was not meant to take up a berth there anyway. A frayed bit of newspaper cut from a longer article refers to a modified treatment of the most advanced form of the unnamed disease, and that several young people were still alive 4 to 8 years later. Surely my father carried that scrap to the Veterans Hospital, offering it as proof of hope. Can't something be done? Perhaps he sat before a discouraging doctor and slipped the paper back into his wallet to have something to do as his ears burned with heartache. On the emergency medical identification card under my doctor, my father wrote Veterans Hospital, no actual doctor's name. He filled the present medical condition thus, leukemia and lymphosarcoma, cancer of the lymphatic system. His diagnosis was eventually switched to Hodgkin's disease, but what difference did it make? My father died on leap year day, February 29th. Just as his medical card lacked the name of a doctor, so my father lacked even a solid day on which to perish. His anniversary death passes invisibly most years, as if even the Roman calendar colludes with some higher powers that foretold my father's always being more spirit than body, just a presence of baffled light on earth. At the time of my father's death, the Des Moines sky hung insufferably dark and low. I was reluctant to leave my mother, so I stayed on for months. One day at the end of summer, I stood outside with my mother and the dogs, admiring flowers in the far backyard. I headed back to the house for a drink of water and walked inside to a ringing phone. When I answered, a rusty-sounding female voice asked, "Is this Mrs. McCoy?" I identified myself, and this woman hesitated before saying that she was Vicky, from Vicky's poorhouse, a friend of my father. She struggled on haltingly to impress upon me just how much my father had meant to her and to many other people, how brave these people knew he was, what he suffered uncomplainingly. She knew about all of us. He had always spoken of us with pride. I remember the tone and rhythm of Vicky's voice and her heavy breathing silences. I gripped the receiver tightly as she spoke. Here was a direct connect to the taboo world, a voice from its darkness, thickly smoked with need and kind words, and slight gulps that did not successfully hold back the sobs. I wasn't used to hearing any adult women of her generation cry. I had never seen or heard my mother cry. I believe she trained herself to swallow pain down to some solid flooring, some cellar part of the heart that locked away the risk of it. I wonder now about the courage it took, of what awful pressing need Vicky bore for months, finally daring to call up my mother, meaning to unburden herself by giving color and humanity to the world that she knew had anguished us. Then, possibly to Vicky's relief, she found me on the phone instead of my mother and switched into a maternal gear, trying to say what a daughter could not yet comprehend, that her father had been a full human being. Vicky, I remember, called me honey. After Vicky said goodbye, I went outside to my mother and the flowers and the dogs. I could not fully comprehend the grace revealed in Vicky's call. An appreciation of the emotional texture of my father's life was not available to me yet. I did not mention the call to my mother. I believed, as I had so often believed in childhood, that I protected her by saying nothing. About a year after Vicky called, high summer now, again my mother and I ranged around the backyard, the dogs in tow as usual. I lived in Iowa City by then, 2 hours away, and had bussed to town to tell my mother of a dream I had had of my father. He stood outside against a luminous blue and yellow sky, wearing a loose shirt that would have been absurd in his day, a V-neck thing, the weave and color of wheat checks. I described the abashed smile I had known all my life, the look on my father's face as he spoke to me. He said, "I parked the car." "Park the car," my mother repeated. Then, after a snort of laughter, "Odds bodkins, wouldn't you know." Death has the power to free the living in unexpected ways, but I was floored, delighted by the way my no-nonsense mother seized on this dream. She embraced it as nothing less than a visitation, and she wanted to get the goods. She asked me to again describe the clothes, the surroundings, his voice saying, "I parked the car." What about the expression on his face? He had that little smile, I said. He was at peace, we understood. We had been stuck in the downside of my father's life and death, the drink, the illness, for way too long. The dream let a little sunshine in. We seized on car memories, what my father nudged us toward. Buying us cars and teaching his children to drive had been the high sovereign province of his parenting. He found exquisite 57 Chevys for both daughters, great gleaming tanks of chrome beauty, and then brought one home for himself. My father's meticulous driving instructions included what to do if the brakes went. Don't jump out of the car, which is what I had imagined doing. That's why I'm telling you, don't jump, he repeated. His caution, I decide now, also serves as a retrospective take on his life's milestones, family, driving life in emergencies, jungle warfare. He did not jump. From descriptions I have read of the New Guinea jungles and the impossible campaign there, the miracle is that any man survived. About one-third of the foot soldiers simply lost their minds. Many died from disease, and others from hand-to-hand combat. Malnutrition, thanks to a horrible shortage of rations early on, claimed a mean share of lives. Self-inflicted wounds, and even allowing jungle rot to claim one's feet, were all too common acts of desperation, a means to getting out. The terrain was unknown to the bigwigs who sank soldiers into its depths along some stretches considered impassable by native residents. Few infantrymen came home to speak openly to their loved ones about slogging day after day through dark jungle cover in torrential rains with no sense of escape or conclusion or peace and no real sleep in the foxholes. Enemy soldiers leaped forth from close distances, my father and others judged accurately, from having played high school football. And yet, another discovery. In remarkably elegant cursive, my father sent home from New Guinea outright cheerful V-mails, philosophically upbeat, even wise little messages to his family, and he always alluded to coming home. He would not pass on his pain. He wrote about eating a great turkey dinner and playing cards by flashlight, and he always alluded to coming home. He would not pass on his pain. He wrote about, sorry, I'm repeating myself. Anyway, he wrote, if you don't hear from me for the next 5 weeks, don't worry. He would be going back into combat. 2 years ago, very near death, my mother admitted only, I know what's happening, but still withheld emotion, and certainly the word death. Her silence, however, was not mine. I told her, I want to make sure we're on the same wavelength. Who knows? You might get in there before I do, but let's promise that someday we'll carry on together as wild women in the Celtic otherworld. The grace of my parents' deaths, the gentle side of that inevitability, comes to me proffered, of course, by love, a new reverence for its nature and reach. Indeed, love lifts the veils between worlds, and there we all find ourselves, witting or not, in its boundlessness. I exult. Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. We didn't point out earlier, there are some copies for you to take of the Cincinnati Review on the ends of the long table. So lucky few of you will go home with one. The rest of you can buy one like the rest of us. Please join us just through those doors for a glass of wine, sparkling water, an almost shockingly tasty, be-cheesed, crunchy cracker. And join me now in thanking our editors and writers.